I wonder if you'd take the pew Bibles and turn to John's Gospel in chapter 12. I thought we might on these next three Sunday mornings just take a little series looking at John's Gospel and looking at some of the Easter mistakes or Easter misunderstandings that crop up as people fail to grasp what is going to happen and what did happen at that first Easter. They're all rather different in nature, but they all revolve around Jesus and discipleship. And I wanted to start this morning with this strange incident at the supper party, which all stems from Judas's question. It's one we find ourselves facing time and time again, I suspect. More than that, probably one that we're asking whenever it comes to spending money, particularly in a religious context. Why not give it to the poor? There's Judas's question, isn't it? Down in verse 5. There's been a quiet supper party. And there's been a little gathering of friends, and you've got them there, I imagine, rather a nice meal. We're told it's at Simon the leper's house, and they've got Mary and Martha, and that's useful because Martha does a lot of the work. And Lazarus, and he's quite a catch these days because he's the star attraction. Everyone wants Lazarus at their supper party, and the disciples are there. And suddenly, in the middle of a pleasant evening, Mary takes this expensive perfume, and in an extravagant gesture, she anoints Jesus. And if you read the incident in Matthew and Mark's Gospel, they tell you that the first thought that seems to come into all the disciples' minds is the one that Judas expresses here. What a waste. What a waste. You can understand it, really, can't you? I mean, she puts the perfume on, she wipes it off again. The smell's all the way through the house. It's reeking of Chanel No. 5 or whatever it is. Why not give it to the poor? It's obviously worth a lot. John goes to great pains to make that clear to us. She took a pound of it. That's a huge amount. It was costly ointment. It was pure, unadulterated. And the thought that comes to their minds is, look, if she'd only sold it, you could put the money to far better use, couldn't you? If we'd given it to the poor, that's what we're here for, isn't it? And Judas's question, it seems to me, picks up exactly the pulse of people's concern today. It's a very topical question, isn't it? Why not give it to the poor? It reflects our conscience. That sort of deep-seated feeling that so many people seem to have that we ought to be helping the poor. We may not always be very clear about why the ought is there, and people would put different reasons if you asked them, but it's there, isn't it? It's the kind thing to do. It's the right thing to do. Maybe the British thing to do. It's certainly the Christian thing to do. And as Mary splurges 300 denarii worth of perfume, that's a working man's wage for a year approximately, the brows go up. Why not sell it? Give the money to save the children. Well, she might at least have bought a Band-Aid record or 20 with that. These gestures, they're all very well, but what about the starving millions? Haven't we heard it? Judas's question reflects our fears, doesn't it? We've got an almost instant suspicion whenever we see unnecessary expense handed over to religious figures. The Maharaj Ji goes around in his Rolls Royce and immediately we wonder. Mr. Moon and his millions, and we nod wisely. And whether you work for the Billy Graham Organization or your Joe Bloggs traveling evangelist, you need to realize that your finances and any signs of affluence, from the notepaper you use to the car you drive in, are going to have to be justified. Because part of the attraction of Jesus, isn't it, is that he was poor. He was humble. He was the one man who had nothing. He'd nowhere to lay his head. He didn't even have a home. He wasn't cluttered about with all these trappings. That's what makes him genuine. And now some hundreds of pounds worth are being spent on him. And as Judas asks the question, why not give it to the poor? Aren't we waiting with anticipation? Good question, Judas. This will give Jesus the chance to put the record straight. Now he'll show his true colours. Reflects our priorities. I mean, it's not just the world that asks these questions. These are Christians who will ask the same questions. They're Christian priorities, aren't they? We share these concerns. Why has Tear Fund had its turnover increase so enormously in recent years? Simply because Christians have sold their ointment and given the checks to Tear Fund to give to the poor. And it's not just the world, but I've no doubt it's our Christian friends who've probably made all of us agonize over our position at St. Helens. We've been put on the spot. All these comments about blessed are the poor and bias to the poor. Christianity is for helping the poor. Why do you go to St. Helens? Why not look after the poor where you are? Well, giving may not be checks, it may just be ourselves. I can remember as I left Norwich, one person coming up to me and saying, I'm very disappointed in you, Hugh, that you're going to St. Helens. I said, why? She said, well, I thought you'd go and help the poor. We've got to face the question, haven't we? We'll face it at gift day, if not before. Why not give the money to the poor? It's what Judas asks. Couldn't be more relevant. Judas's question. And then before we come to what Jesus has to say, just notice this, will you? In verse 6, John's warning. This he said, not that Judas cared for the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to take what was put into it. It's a devastating little reminder in that verse that brilliant questions are sometimes not genuine ones. And that was the case for Judas. Life was getting quite hard for him. I mean, if you're used to putting your hand in the till and there isn't any money going in there in the first place, it's getting difficult. And that's what was happening for him. I mean, if the program had been going in those days, Roger Cook and Checkpoint would have had a field day with this, wouldn't they? It's exactly the sort of thing that he'd be investigating. You can imagine him. I wonder, Mr. Iscariot, if you could just answer some questions that some of your clients have about what's happening to their money. And it's in those rather measured tones that Roger Cook often uses that John refers to it here. There's not a tirade against Judas, is there? Merely states the facts. Leaves us to draw our own conclusions. He was a disciple. Verse 4, he was going to betray him. He carried the money box and he took the money. He was on the take. That little word in verse 6, there's a pun in the Greek there. The Greek word means to carry and to carry off, and Judas did both. Matthew and Mark don't talk about Judas saying this. They say it was the question all the disciples asked, why not give it to the poor? John is the one who identifies Judas as the one man who not only thought that question, but had it as more than a passing thought. But in the other Gospels, you'll find immediately this incident is followed with Judas going to betray Jesus to the chief priests. He can't make his money this way, dipping into the till, so he'll go and make it another way. Don't you meet, as I do, people who are always feeling sorry for Judas? It sounded a wonderfully selfless question. It was actually one that was full of vested interest. And it's a little warning we need to remember that there are questions like that today. The question, why give to the poor, can actually be full of self-interest. Not always asked with a pure motive. It's not always asked saying, surely this must be the best way to serve God, and please, I want to know what is if it's not. Sometimes asked as, please reassure me, that's an easy way to get God off my back. Please, what about the poor? Because that saves me having to face up to other embarrassing questions. I've never been to a university mission so far without someone coming up and asking me, wouldn't it be better to have spent all the money on this mission and given it to the poor rather than come and bother me with the gospel? Judas's question. John's warning. But Jesus, you'll notice, when you come to verses 7 and 8, doesn't take up John's warning. He treats Judas at face value. He's probably the one person in the room who knows at the time that Judas is fiddling the books. But he seems to realize that even if this question isn't genuine coming from Judas, it is in the minds of the disciples, it will be for many. And he takes it at its best. And that's why his answer is so surprising, isn't it? Why not give it to the poor? Come on, Jesus, tell her. And it's very clear as you look at verses 7 to 8 that he accepts her action. Let her alone. No, she's okay. Now, I must confess that I'd always thought that this was a story about discipleship, about love for Jesus and showing it. Well, it is, and we'll come to that in a moment. But what I discovered this week for the first time is that actually, first and foremost, it's about something completely different. It's a story about Jesus and who he is. And Jesus' verdict, as he's asked for it, begins by throwing light on himself. Do you see what he says, verse 8? The poor you always have with you, but you don't always have me. Jesus is actually saying, listen, yes, I know the poor are very, very important, but at this moment in time, as they put it, I am more important. Oh, you mean all those fears and conscience and priorities about the poor are wrong? Well, no. No, not really. That's what makes this sentence so striking. You see, it's true that Jesus did teach a lot about our attitude to the poor. Go back a few pages to Matthew 25. Story of the sheep and the goats. Remember, look. Here we are. Here's the sheep at his right hand, and the king on the judgment day says, come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom, verse 34, prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Yes. It does seem to be some test of our discipleship. He practiced what he preached. We're not surprised about that. Come back to John's Gospel and just turn over a page to chapter 13. And when you look at verse 29, it's Jesus telling Judas at the Last Supper, what you're going to do, do quickly. Of course, Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him. The others obviously didn't. Some thought that because Judas had the money box, Jesus was telling him, buy what we need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. Clearly seemed to be a regular habit of theirs, and he imagined these other disciples that Jesus was simply saying to Judas, go on, another handout. You'll find the early church took it up as a high priority. That's why they got into trouble in Acts 6 as they tried to feed all the widows. That's why when Paul went to check his gospel in Jerusalem with Peter and James, they accepted it. And in the end they said there was only one thing, they'd have us remember the poor. Paul said the very thing I was eager to do. Very high priority. Jesus is simply saying here, yes, it is a high priority, but I'm higher. It's a devastating sentence. The poor you always have with you. Yes, there's the implication again. They'll always be there. They'll always be the need. You're always to look after it. But you don't always have me. And there's a very strong contrast in this sentence in the original between the poor and between me. It's an uncomfortable saying, isn't it? It makes us revise so many views about Jesus, or at least about humility as we seem to think of it. It's very ego-centered. It's the complete opposite of what he's meant to say, according to popular myth, isn't it? He's really meant to say, yes, 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 what a waste on me. Don't worry about me. Sort out the poor. It's the mark of someone who isn't merely a good cause, Christ. You know, the Christ who's really there as the kind of the great sponsor of every good cause that's going. There's something more on his mind. And clearly from verse 7, that something more is his death. Let her keep it, he says. Let her keep it not for the poor, but for my burial. Now, I must admit, whenever I've looked at these verses or heard people explain them, I've always sort of grimaced to myself at this stage. Mary did something in the middle of a supper party, and Jesus, so in answering, talks about the unexpected. He just drags his death into it, it seems, from nowhere. It's not what we'd expect. Normally, anointing was a sign of revelry and enjoyment. And he seems to be implying that she knew what she was doing. And whenever I've heard this, I've always sort of thought, well, how could she have known? Isn't it just Jesus sort of twisting things around a little bit? But that's because I've always read it out of context. And I've just read these 8 verses. And the disciples have such trouble in understanding it because they seem to me so often to be living things out of context. And as I stopped to read back through John and to try and see where he was going in the gospel, I discovered that he's not the sort of ethereal, otherworldly gospel that I'd always imagined, but he's got all sorts of pace and excitement and tension and movement through his gospel. He knows exactly where he's going. And one of the motifs you can't fail to pick up is this one of conflict and death. And as we come through chapters 10, 11 and 12, the drum is beating louder and louder on this theme. Turn back a page and see what I mean. You'll find it's coming up more and more and more. Chapter 10, verse 31. The Jews took up stones to stone him. Well, when that doesn't get very far, verse 39, again they tried to arrest him, but he escaped from their hands. Chapter 11, we have the incident about Lazarus, and if you turn over to verse 15 and 16, you remember there's this delay, and they hear that Lazarus is dead, and Jesus says that Lazarus is dead, let's go to him. And Thomas, who seems to be taking the place normally reserved for Peter, is the one who steps in and shows he clearly doesn't understand what's going on. He says, let's also go that we may die with him. There must be some great sense that death is just round the corner for Thomas to be thinking that's what Jesus is on about. And at the end of chapter 11, look, verse 53. This is after the miracle of Lazarus, which seems to be the final straw. The crowds are flocking round Jesus. So the plot thickens. From that day on, they took counsel how to put him to death. Jesus isn't going along openly amongst the Jews, verse 54. And at the end of chapter 11, it's the Passover at hand. The crowds are flocking to Jerusalem for the countryside, and the buzz that's going all round the marketplaces is about this Jesus. Is he here or isn't he? Will he come or won't he? And we feel as a religious man he must come, and yet they know the wanted posters are up. Now the supper party comes in that context, doesn't it? It's a kind of lull before the storm, isn't it? Not some sedate, marvellous little affair at Hampstead. No. There's death all around it. And it's not actually so much the plotting of others, because go back again to chapter 10, and you'll see that Jesus has made it quite clear that it's not what the others were plotting. He's avoided those plots all the way through this gospel. It's what he's heading for himself. Chapter 10, verse 11. I'm the good shepherd, he says. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Verse 17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord." Now it's this death, he's saying, that makes me even more important than the poor. And Mary has spotted it. Don't ask me why. Maybe she noticed he was more thoughtful, he was quieter. Maybe she just understood these things quicker than the others. But she spotted it, and she's responded. And it's if we never understand this, if we don't get Easter and all that it involves right, we'll always be confused over our priorities. We'll never answer Judas's question if we haven't seen what Mary began to see. Jesus says, "No, leave her alone. Let her keep it, not for the poor, but for my burial. They're always here. I'm not." And he throws light on himself and also light on our discipleship. He's very, very shrewd, isn't it? His insights into our nature. He's conscious that if you ask Judas's question with the best of motives in a situation like this, the danger we lie in is of letting our love for the service of Christ, of the interests of Christ, actually become greater than our love for Christ himself. Why do we ask this question? Because they were all concerned about the poor and they'd forgotten about Jesus. Our Christianity gets reduced so quickly, doesn't it, to a little philosophy, a little tenet, love the poor. And it's just veered off from the person. Love Christ. Jesus shrewdly sees the danger of a discipleship that has merely added to an intellectual belief a strict discipline. A calculating of what would be the best to do in this, this and this. And he sees that because actually the discipleship is a discipleship of a person, it involves things like love and loyalty, and they're not always calculating. Jesus won't be here much longer. It's now or never for devotion to him. He's wary of those who've become so stereotyped that we've lost our love, that everything has to be done by the book so we can never splurge. Isn't that what Mary does? It's not a pattern of discipleship he's commending here. No, no, no. Discipleship doesn't consist of just a series of extravagant gestures. Any more than that's what marriage is about. But, I mean, Claire and I went on a splurge last week. I sincerely hope she doesn't think that's what marriage is all about. We can't afford that every week. We can't afford it every month. If that's all that's holding our marriage together, we're in desperate trouble, aren't we? But never to splurge. I mean, never to take her out for a meal, even to a wimpy. Never any flowers. What's the relationship? Isn't that what's going on here? Last time I heard someone talk about Mary's gesture here, they finished their sermon by saying, it's the archetypal woman's gesture. And I nodded, because you're meant to nod at what people say in sermons. And I just had this sort of slight alarm bell going in the back of my mind. Was this a sort of male chauvinist comment? And thinking about it, I'm sure now it needs correcting. But not because it's anti-woman. Far from it. If all this is a typical woman's gesture, it's very anti-man. It's actually saying that none of us have enough sensitivity to understand what Christ went through. None of us have enough gratitude to be extravagantly grateful. What sort of disciples does it leave us as? If, like me, you feel, well, at the end of every talk, you ought to know very clearly what you're meant to be doing, and you're trying to say, well, what do I do about this? How do I become extravagantly grateful? And you're trying to work out what sort of gesture would be extravagant, and you've got your calculator out, and you're adding it up in your notebook. We've obviously missed the point, haven't we? It's not the way to get the heart of a Mary. She was like this because she'd begun to understand Easter, hadn't she? She'd begun to get it into her mind and her heart. She began to see here was a Christ who doesn't just say, give to the poor, but he says, I'm laying down my life for the sheep. And that's what enabled her to get her priorities right, to make sure that her love for Christ was never dulled by that subtlest of snares, love for his service. It's only as we begin to get Easter right and get Easter into our minds and our hearts, well, that we'll have something of this discipleship, and we can add to the worthy service of a Martha the extravagant gratitude of a Mary. May God make that us.